everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the war no one wants to talk about. Is there a genocide underway in Yemen? Cutting through the lies of Washington and the American media and American allies, such as Saudi Arabia. My guest from the United Kingdom on Skype is Kim Sharif. She's an attorney in the United Kingdom and the director of the nonprofit human justice organization Human Rights Watch Yemen. She is Yemeni by birth. She's a Shiite Muslim. She's a leading fixture exposing that part of what we're not told, the lies, in the media. Needless to say, if you're going to tell the people the truth, and if you're one of the perpetrators of the lie, you don't want to have someone on exposing him. So she has not had the kind of exposure in the United States that she deserves and the topic deserves. Many of us believe that the United States and the United Kingdom are engaged in an illegal war being waged by Saudi Arabia upon the diverse populations in Yemen and with the military assistance of many other supporters. She has been campaigning on behalf of the people of Yemen since the war started and has taken part in many NGO human rights and anti-war panels in the United Kingdom and Geneva to increase public awareness of the genocide underway. Nice to have you with us today, Kim.
Good afternoon to you, sir. Thank you so much for having me as a guest on your program. I'm delighted to be with you today as a guest.
I started by introducing the program by calling the crisis in Yemen a war that nobody wants to speak about. And for this conversation, this is probably most true in the United States, where there's almost a complete blackout on what is happening in Yemen, aside from the occasional report about Obama's drone strikes to remove al-Qaeda factions. And we will certainly get to that. Then, to a lesser extent, we know that Saudi Arabia is conducting numerous aerial strikes and bombing campaigns, but we don't know really what, aside from it targeting certain factions that our media wants to frame as being insurgent militias against a regime which we are told is the legitimate government. So we're confused. And that is pretty much the story we are told, not too dissimilar from the media outrage on the war in Somalia and the United States military and covert operations there. But before we get into the details of this war that is being systematically distorted by the U.S. government and our complicit media, I think it's important to allow you to give us your substantial overview about Yemen, because until we know its strategic location, what it borders, like, for example, sharing a border with Saudi Arabia, the diversity of its religious culture within Islam, in other words, the different religious groups similar to Syria's diversity, and a little bit about Yemen's history, its legacy within Islam, civilization itself. Because when we start looking later at Saudi Arabia's role in this war, we're going to have to look at its Salafi Wahhabi doctrine as well. So begin, please, by giving us a history lesson. Take your time. There's no commercials. There's no interruption. It's just you and I for this hour. So you don't have to rush through anything. We are uneducated on the topic. We need your insight so that we can understand the kind of genocide against Shias and other non-Salafi sects that populate Yemen geographically. The forum is yours.
Thank you very much, sir. Basically, the background to the Yemen is, as we might know a little bit about it, we hear about Queen Sheba in our own literature and culture, and we know about King Solomon's wife, Sheba. Sheba's originally from, she was the queen of the Yemen. She was the queen of that entire empire, which included northeastern Africa and the Arabian states there. She was the queen of that part. So Yemen is basically thousands of years old civilization in the world. In fact, it's one of the oldest civilizations in the world. Yemen is the first country in the world that invented the concept of having multi-layered buildings. So these high-rising that we're having today here in the West is not something new to the Yemenis. They've had that thousands of years ago. There are lots of amazing heritage sites that have that were under UNESCO protection, about which I'll be saying something later on when I'm going to touch on the war against the Yemen by the Saudi-led coalition. So historically, Yemen is one of the is the oldest civilization there, one of the oldest civilizations there, sophisticated nation. The population is mainly of Muslim, a variety of Muslim Islamic sects. You get the Zaydi Shias, you get Twelver Shias, you get Ismaili Shias. You also get a variety of Sunnis from the Shafi background. Some recent development, I say recent, I'll be saying something about that later on when I touch on the Salafis, recent Wahhabi injection into the Yemen by the by its neighbors, the Saudi regime. They are a minority, definitely. There's also Hanafis, and they have always coexisted with each other without any difficulty. Historically, the Yemen was divided into north and south. And then they had the civil war in the early 90s, where they then decided to merge and become United Yemen. And one of the most interesting things we need to remember about Yemen throughout my chat with you is the fact that Yemen is a republic, and it is surrounded by sheikhdoms, fiefdoms, principalities, absolute monarchies and dictatorships. As an Arab nation, therefore, Yemen is the only democratic republic in the region. South of Yemen used to be historically British protectorate, but then it got its independence in sometime in the 60s, I believe. And so historically, roughly, briefly, that is what the Yemen is about. Culturally, very, very rich. The population is very tribal, contains so many different tribes. And the culture and tradition of the people of Yemen is also very tribal-based. And but they have always coexisted without any difficulty. What we find happening in Yemen is on or about 2011, where we have the Arab Spring having kind of a domino effect in the region. Apart from Tunis and Egypt, Yemen was the other country that was very badly affected by the Arab Spring, where they deposed the former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was ruling the country for about 33 years at the time. And by an agreement and with the intervention of the Gulf Cooperation Council and, in essence, through Saudi intervention and bullying, they came to an agreement which became known as the Gulf Initiative. This instrument is very important because this is what they are using, the Saudi-led coalition supported by the UK and US in this aggressive war. They're using this Gulf Initiative to give the former President Hadi legitimacy. And they're saying they're fighting, they're destroying, killing, doing all they're doing in order to restore the legitimate, what they regard as a legitimate president. Now, one thing we need to bear in mind throughout is this. We, as mature democracies, such as the UK and the US, it really isn't appropriate for us to be using regimes, brutal dictators, such as the Saudis, absolute monarchies, to superimpose or enforce rules of law concerning democratic processes of other sovereign nations, which are republics like the Yemen, because that is completely contradictory in essence, and we shouldn't be allowing that. It's unthinkable for a brutal dictator to be told, oh, you can go and restore former president of the country. That's not allowed. There is no rule of law that allows that. Anyhow, where the Gulf Initiative's agreement was that Mr. Hadi would take over from Ali Abdullah Saleh for a limited period of 2 years, during which time he was to organize general elections for the people of the Yemen to choose their new president. He was a caretaking president in essence, during the 2 year period. That Gulf Initiative initial presidency period came to an end in February 2014. What Mr. Hadi did was he had built himself a quango of corrupt officials who were from his own Islah Party. The Islah Party is the Muslim Brotherhood of the Yemen. Mr. Hadi himself is from the Muslim Brotherhood. So is the general that is with him on his side, Ali Mohsen Ahmar. So Mr. Hadi's presidency is coming to an end in February 2014. He, with his quango of corrupt officials, decided to extend that initial caretaking period by a further 1 year to expire in February 2015. So by September 2014, the people of the country have noticed that Mr. Hadi was doing nothing about preparation for the elections, no candidates, not involving the various political parties in the process of preparation of elections and things like that. So they thought there was something amiss. And so what you then get is a coalition of the Yemen army, a political party known as Ansarullah, about whom you will often hear in the media being referred to as the Houthis. So you get the Yemen army, Ansarullah. You get the Congress Party, which is the party of the former president Ali Abdullah Saleh. You have various other parties, such as Party of Righteousness, and many, many others. Yemen has many, many, many political parties. And so all of these people with the tribes of the Yemen, tribe elders, got together and they sort of besieged the capital, Sana'a, demanding that Mr. Hadi either step down or make immediate announcements about the proposed elections and what he was supposed to do under the Gulf Initiative. Now, Mr. Hadi, instead of addressing what the people were asking for, decided to just run away in women's clothing and hid in the south. And from there, it appears he readied his people. He already had. I think this whole thing was planned a long time ago. So a whole lot of people who are Hadi supporters in the south on standby. And as he is making his way out of Aden onto Muscat, he says the Saudi-led coalition bombardment starts. In essence, in a TV interview, Mr. Hadi admits that he did not know that the aerial strikes or bombardment would start, let alone ask them to intervene in the Yemen in order to restore him to power. So, having done that, then what happens is when Mr. Hadi leaves the country in a political vacuum, then the coalition who were besieging the capital city, Sana'a, move in and take the capital, and they move with the army to all other parts of the country, and quite a lot of places just surrender without difficulty. That included the Ib district, some southern districts, and Sana'a and many others. And of course, Sa'da was not resistant in any event to the army and coalition party. So when the Houthis take over the capital in September 2014, Mr. Hadi runs away. We then see a movement of embassies of the UK and the US and quite a few of their allies packing their things and leaving the capital, Sana'a, very quickly, taking all their stuff and advising their nationals not to be there or not to come there. And by January 2015, with the involvement of the UN representative to the Yemen, Mr. Jamal Ben, all the parties that have taken over the capital and the other districts of the Yemen came together in a hotel called Mozambique, and there they had a conference where they debated, negotiated, and settled everything about what to do with the country in terms of having election, having a president, having everything. So they came to a new agreement effectively, because at that point it seems the Gulf Initiative has come to an end effectively and died by its own, by operation of law, if you know what I mean, in the sense that the man who was handling it, his period had expired. The new period before it could expire, it was shown he ran away and left his post. And when he was asked to come back to maintain his position, he refused twice. He was asked, he refused. And Jamal Ben, UN representative, is a living witness to these events. And if he is asked, he should be honest enough to tell the truth about what has gone on. So by February 2015, all the Yemeni parties had agreed about what to do with their country. They were only debating which man to have as their president from among a number of candidates that they had put forward. And by about March, they were very close to agreeing, by about the end of March, they were very close to agreeing the name of that man. And then on 26 March, the Saudi regime announces a coalition of many other Arab and non-Arab nations with it. And they start a hysterical aerial bombardment of the Yemen without any prior warning or announcement, hitting the capital at every part. All that historical architectural beauty that I have described to you earlier has been practically ruined, leaving absolutely nothing. They've hit just about every hospital and medical center in the Yemen. And last report I saw, it showed about 117, and there are likely to be much more than that because there have been continued strikes on the Yemen. They hit over 500 schools and education centers, practically everything in the country, in other words. They have destroyed all factories, even crisps and chips-making factories, killing women working in there. And each time they target these civilian places, they claim they were told that there were weapons there of the Houthis. And so in reality, figures-wise, what we have is over 12,000, I'm exaggerating if I said over 13 or 14,000 dead, nearly 60,000 injured, over 3 million internally displaced, over 18 million facing immediate starvation. The Yemen is about a population of 26 million people, and about tens of thousands of them are stranded in airports outside the country because there is a blockade against the country. The Saudis won't allow flights in and out of Sana'a, and even the ports aren't allowed to import and export anything without the Saudis detaining at the main out of the port of Hodeidah and the port of Aden, so because they're controlling the air and the seas in those parts. So they're starving the country and collectively punishing them. They have used in their raids cluster bombs made by the US and the UK. They have used other chemical weapons. They use uranium-enriched bombs on the mounts of Atan and Naqam and quite a few other places. They have committed genocide in Mahar when they hit the compounds of the workers of a nearby electricity center. They hit wedding parties twice, killing up to hundreds of people in it. They hit public bathing places, public baths where you have saunas and steam baths. They hit those places. They hit civilian targets, like a judge who was known and famous for fighting terrorism in the Yemen, Judge Rubaida. His house was specifically targeted and hit because he issued a warrant for the arrest of some terrorists who were supporting Mr. Hadi. And so the place is an absolute chaos at the moment, and there seems to be complete and shocking, horrific silence about the ongoing war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide in the Yemen. Legally, in terms of genocide, it's quite straightforward. A number, more than 100 incidents of genocide exists in the Yemen. In relation to the Houthis, for example, it's straightforward because the Saudis don't make it a secret, make it very clear that they are there to kill Houthis. Now, from international community perspective, the UN, the UN has passed a resolution known as 2216, and resolution 2216 is orders the Ansarullah Party and Ali Abdullah Saleh, the former president of the country, who unites with Sayyid Abdul Malik Badruddin al-Houthi, who is the leader of Ansarullah, who are defending the country along with the army and the coalition parties. The resolution just says they must hand over all their weapons and they must leave the cities that they have taken. It doesn't authorize expressly use of force, certainly not in this illegal sense of semi-nuclear bombs being used on Atan and elsewhere, cluster bombs being used routinely every day, especially in the Sada area, and targeting civilian places with chemical and other biological weapons, which is what the Saudis have been doing so far. Incidence of cancer is on the increase shockingly. From one-year-olds to 40-year-olds, everyone is getting cancer, like it happened in Chernobyl many years ago when there was a nuclear disaster. So, who are the parties? Now, Ansarullah Party is, like I was saying earlier, led by a man called Sayyid Abdul Malik Badruddin al-Houthi. And he is in alliance with Ali Abdullah Saleh, who is the former president of the country, who is also the head of the Congress Party. And so these two main political parties have recently formed an alliance and created a Supreme Political Council to lead the country, thereby sealing the vacuum, the political vacuum created by the lack of a government. So the country now does have a government represented by these parties in agreement with all other parties and tribal elders who represent their different communities. If you think of the tribal elders like local sort of councillors of local areas, local area MPs, if you like, representing the interests of local communities. And so that is where we are at the moment. And as we speak, the hysterical bombardment continues nonstop. Now, who are the countries that are involved in this coalition of death squads? You get Jordan, you get Morocco, you get Egypt, you get Senegal, you get Kuwait, Bahrain, Emirates, especially Emirates, one of the prominent figures. You get Qatar. You get Pakistan in some way, and in total, you've got about 14 countries in alliance with the Saudis out there butchering Yemeni children and women and elderly every day, ruthlessly, without anyone saying so much as one word of stop this genocide now. This is worse than Hitler. And where we are now, yes, the continuation of the genocide is there. The war crimes are there. As we speak, let me give you figures of the last few days of what happened. On the 8th of September, there was a raid in a place called Amran in the market. Eight were dead instantly, five were injured. On the 10th of September, there was a raid on the house of a man called Maqbul al-Hamali, and six were killed of his family. 9th of September, again, house of Saadan. They did there what is known as double or triple tap. Double and triple tap is where the airstrikes come. They hit a busy market, for example, and then they fly up. And when people come to rescue, so obviously people will run to their rescue. So they come back and hit the place again. So the intention is to kill more people rather than destroying weapons or finding houses, as they say. And then they hit a third time to make sure maximum number of killings. So the Saudis have every intention to kill Yemenis, irrespective of who they are, whether they're Shia, Sunnis, Christians, Jewish, or other people. We do have Christians in Yemen. We do have Jewish communities in Yemen. And I'm glad to say our Jewish brothers are standing with us and are saying we are not with this atrocity being committed against the Yemen, not in our name, and they do work with us and campaign with us, I'm glad to say. So where we're at now, we're at in a place worse than Second World War genocide by the Nazi Germany regime, and we're just sitting back and doing nothing about it. And furthermore, the UK and the US, the world's most respected and prominent democracies, have really lowered themselves in the estimation of all by actually continuing to supply weapons to this brutal dictatorship regime that doesn't understand democracy and can't obviously accept that its neighbor, an Arab nation, Yemen, can be an independent democratic republic, because it's a threat to it. Why is it a threat? Because it is a brutal dictator that crushes any sense of independence or freedom in its own country. It doesn't allow women to drive a car, let alone express any political view or do anything human. In fact, they had a conference 3 weeks ago in Saudi Arabia where they were debating whether women are animals or humans. I'm not exaggerating. I do have evidence to back this. So in terms of the war crimes, the genocide, and all the other atrocities they have been committing in the Yemen, we do have recorded evidence, and the evidence has been building and piling. The UN Human Rights Council itself reported about the breaches of Geneva Conventions and the international human rights and humanitarian law. Medical centers like Médecins Sans Frontières didn't go safe with these people. In fact, Médecins Sans Frontières have now decided to leave the Yemen because they've suffered at least four or five raids by the Saudis, despite the fact that their location is clear and they have coordinated with the war rooms of the Saudis about their location and the fact that they are an independent NGO. They just come back and hit them. One of their workers was killed recently as a result of a raid by the Saudis. So it is a seriously disgusting, revolting mess and compromise on our values as lovers of democracy and freedom for us to be associating, dealing, or even working, let alone supplying weapons and giving them logistics and intelligence support in this illegal war against this poor nation in the region.
Okay, Kim, I just need you to relax for a moment because you've made a lot of statements. Now, I want to try to put this into some perspective for our audience, then I'll continue asking you some questions, all right? First, from what I'm hearing you say, there are about 26 million people living in this, one of the oldest civilizations in the world, and that has a phenomenal history. But it's also now one of the driest, poorest, least developed countries in the world. It ranks 140th out of 182 countries on the United Nations Development Program's Human Development Index. And about 42% of the entire population are very poor. One in five Yemenis live in malnutrition. It's endemic. Also, here what you have at the heart of this is you have Saudi Arabia and its form of Islam, Wahhabism, which is the most radical and from which ISIS and other groups have sprung. Then you have the United States under Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton continuing to give Saudi Arabia, even though we now know it was complicit in funding and support of the terrorists in 9/11. We know that from the 28 pages, from the redacted pages from the FBI, plus an additional 80,000 pages. But we know that here we just celebrated 9/11, the 15th anniversary of those who suffered. It is heartbreaking, and I did a seven-hour special on it with experts who, the experts I did not allow to conjecture or to surmise what happened. I merely asked them to deconstruct what they know did not happen. So their mandate for 7 hours, these engineers, these scientists, these journalists, were to go through the official report and show us what was not true. And at the end of this, there's so much compelling evidence of what was not true that any responsible and reasonable person would say, why would we not want to open up a new independent investigation? Similarly, if we did open up an independent investigation, there's a high probability that we would find Saudi Arabia was behind this, either complicit with our knowledge or without our knowledge. But from then till now, the largest purchaser of weapons from us has been Saudi Arabia. Hundreds of billions of dollars. Also, they have given us a position on oil. We don't need their oil. We have enough oil that can come in from Canada, our own production of oil, that we don't need it. But they have an enormous amount of our debt. They bought treasury bills. They bought what are called T-bills. And a T-bill is nothing more than an IOU. It's not the same as a dollar bill. You don't buy a T-bill to spend it. You buy it to hold it because if anything ever happens to you, your assets, your home, your business, you always have something to back up. Your final plan B, it's a backstop to economic crisis because it's backed by the full support and confidence in the United States government. And the United States government cannot go bankrupt because it has a central bank, the Federal Reserve, and it can produce all the money at once. And so therefore, the Saudis have purchased, second only to China. China, I believe, has $1.7 trillion, but Saudi Arabia has around somewhere between $700 to $800 billion. And Saudi Arabia has let it be known that if the people from the victims' families sue, and now every single member of the Senate, every single member of the House voted unanimously to allow Americans to sue any country that participated in the attack of 9/11 or any other attack in the United States. So now behind the scenes, we're told that if Obama doesn't veto this, by the way, there's enough votes to override his veto, that they will dump $800 billion of our debt on the market, which could really adversely affect the value of the stock market. It could crash it. and also the value of the dollar. It would substantially adversely affect it. So now we have a Secretary of State who has said in her secret emails that WikiLeaks allowed us to see that she calls out Saudi Arabia for supporting terrorism, supporting torture, supporting arming of Islamic groups, and of the abating in terrorist activities in the Middle East, and specifically Syria. So it's not that she doesn't know the truth, or the National Security Agency, or the FBI, or the CIA. They all know that Saudi Arabia is the number one terrorist nation on the planet, besides the United States. Right. They know this. Then you said, but how bad is it? Well, it's so bad that in Yemen, there were 15 airports destroyed, 12 ports destroyed, 137 stations and power generators, which, by the way, are a violation of the Geneva Accords because you're not allowed to destroy intentionally any infrastructure that impacts the capacity of a person to live. Like you couldn't knock out their electricity because that affects their water purification. That would be considered a crime of a war crime. But Saudi Arabia and its allies, including Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, Jordan, Qatar, they were involved in knocking out 195 water tank and networks. So all the fresh drinking water they intentionally destroyed. They destroyed 206 stations and communication networks. They destroyed 1,419 government facilities. They destroyed 653 mosques, but not Sunni mosques, Shia mosques. They destroyed 654 schools and institutions, again, violations of the Geneva Convention, 254 health facilities, hospitals, 174 tourist facilities, 195 archaeological sites. Now, some of these sites you mentioned are some of the most famous biblical and historical sites on the planet in all of antiquity. They're gone, destroyed to rubble.
That's right.
4,757 stores, 1,959 transportation hubs, 584 food stores, 450 places where food is brought in to be distributed. They destroyed 494 public markets. They destroyed 252 fuel stations, 218 factories. And and as a result, in this small country, and you look at the population and you look at how much damage has been done. They destroyed 140 poultry farms. They destroyed 198 fuel tankers. Well, they literally destroyed 330,582 homes and businesses damaged or destroyed, 48 sports facilities, 43 universities. So there's nothing left to destroy. They've destroyed everything that they could, all for what? And the bottom line from what I'm hearing you say is because historically, it was a nation that tolerated and accepted multiple religious views. That they had it was historically run by multiple tribes in different areas of the country, that had their own view of what their life and their purpose was. But Saudi Arabia brought in its own figurehead, supposedly temporarily. But the Saudis are always devious. Can never trust what they say. It's really a family of 5,000 more or less dysfunctional, spoiled brats who look at women as sexual objects only and have no relevance or spiritual value at all. They don't even consider them human. They have no rights of assembly, no freedom of speech. There's no religion allowed outside of Islam in Saudi Arabia. And it is a completely closed society. And the monarchy, which is by the most feeble-minded and intellectually inferior group of monarchs in history, know that if there was any freedom, their own people, their own countrymen in Saudi Arabia would throw them out and hold them accountable. They have repressed the Shia in their country. They assassinated. They cut the head off. The nonviolent Shia leader recently in the last 12 months.
That's right.
They know they can get away with this because they've given $35 million to the Clinton Foundation, and there you pay to play. They know that Obama they can intimidate. And so they hold the power of the purse string, even though at this moment they are not broke. They have a $69 billion cash flow deficit, but they also are holding $500 to $600 billion in oil reserves, and their oil company is worth over $2 trillion, one of the 10 wealthiest corporations in the world. And they're looking to sell some interest in it. So nothing's going to happen, no matter how many destroyed buildings, no matter how poor the people are, no matter how many civilians suffer. The New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN especially, I don't even know how anybody can actually call them a news organization. They're a propaganda organization. They'd have been better suited under Joseph Goebbels and the Nazi regime as the good Nazi, because they don't represent truth at any level. So nothing's going to happen. So all we're going to do is we're going to watch this genocide take place.
Yes.
Because the American media is hiding it. But you've got the corruption of an imperialist, never outgrew their colonialist ideals, of Great Britain being a part of this, supporting Saudi Arabia, because they're selling them arms, they're selling them cluster bombs, they're selling munitions.
Am I accurate or inaccurate
in what you have told us today?
Yeah. Well, it's a heartbreaking situation, kind of a catch-22, like you quite rightly pointed out. But there is, of course, for every problem, there is a solution. In terms of our royal family here and our system here, as a British national, as a lawyer, I owe a duty of care and loyalty to my queen, and that's part of the deal of my being here. Otherwise, if I don't love and be loyal to my country, I don't feel a need for me to be here anymore. And why am I campaigning? Not just because I'm moved by the inhuman way of being out handling the situation in Yemen, and I'm saying as a British woman, not in our name, and it's not part of our great British values for us to be supplying weapons to a regime that is known to be so brutal in its practices, not only in relation to the Yemen, but it's in relation to world affairs. You see, I haven't recovered yet entirely from the shock of July the 7th here in London. You see, on the 7th of July 2005, we had the attack on the underground by extremist terrorist groups that caused more than 50 deaths and hundreds of injuries. It was the most horrific sight, because our underground transport system tends to be very busy at that time when it was targeted. By the same token, I haven't entirely really still recovered from the shock of 9/11. It's still lingering in my head after thousands of people being murdered like that. It's not acceptable. So the question is, 15 of 9/11 were the Saudi nationals. The U.S. authorities have now finally at least have given the green light for legal steps to be taken to bring justice for the victims of 9/11, which is absolutely correct, and I do my own campaigns here in relation to that, because I think the people of New York deserve, the people of the U.S. deserve justice over that, and we need to get to the bottom of this. I did see what you said about Mrs. Clinton, that she does know the truth, that this terrorism is emanating from this regime, and I did see the clip of that video where she's saying they just must stop funding these terror groups and stop helping them. Well, that little statement isn't enough. We need to be taking further steps than that, because for the past 16 years, we have been in a war with a terror. And that meant so much suffering for so many people from so many different communities all over the world. And when we research and look and go to the bottom of the source of what is this evil in the world called terrorism, we will find, for example, Boko Haram, terrorist group in Nigeria, Al-Shabaab, terrorist group in Somalia, Taliban, terrorist group in Afghanistan and Pakistan, Daesh, terrorist group all over the Middle East areas, Al-Qaeda, and the gang leaders of all of them, evildoers. All of these groups, extremist, violent, vicious, nasty, the monsters have one thing in common. They are all Wahhabis. And their Bible, literally, is a book called Kitab al-Tawheed, which means, translated into English, the Book of the Oneness of God, which was written by the leader of this sect that calls itself Wahhabism, explaining about the rules of existence. It's an entirely brand new religion, effectively, going well outside of Islam almost altogether. They have nothing to do with Islam apart from using the word. In terms of practices, their practice has nothing to do with all other practice Islamic sects that I am familiar with. And I have been researching Islam for the past 11 years, and I have been motivated by this very subject to get to the bottom of this problem, who is behind this, to see if Wahhabism is really, in fact, part of Islam. And I discovered that Wahhabism is more a political ideology designed to control and oppress masses. It's nothing to do with religious faith and divinities and going to hell and heaven, none whatsoever, because all its practices, addictions, fatwas, and all of that is more to do with destruction and killing anyone who is not Wahhabi. That includes Muslims, Buddhists, Christians, Jewish, all other faith people and non-faith people, because they're not living like the Wahhabis. And the Wahhabis also have dictions to say if a person's parents aren't also praying, a Muslim is entitled to go and kill them. This is not the Islam that we all know. In fact, I was born to a family who were Sufi Shafi'is, a Sunni sect, so I'm familiar with the Sunni practices. I also used to live in Saudi Arabia, so I know Wahhabi practices. And having spent the last 30 years or more of my life in the UK and being an independent woman, I've come to the conclusion that Shiism is the right path. And so I have adopted Shiism, and I live by that. And I will hopefully continue that, because it's the most peaceful, encompassing, humane system of belief in all the other religious sections that I have studied in my life in the world. So I'm settled here. Now, that takes us then back to the Saudis, and also our problem as nations that have great values, that have something to do with humanitarianism, that have something to do with democracy, that have something to do with fairness and justice. We can't, as nations who have been all our lives standing up for the poor, for the weak, and defending, even if only merely theoretically, afford to then be associating with rogue regimes that are actually supplying us with terrorism, which is the case here with the Saudi regime, because they are Wahhabis. So all this terror is coming from them. They're not only supplying it to us here in the West, they're also supplying it to poor African nations and Asian nations. What the Saudis do is they just use petrol dollars to purchase political alliances, to purchase religious alliances, to purchase all kinds of alliances. But in the world today, we have an international system, organizations, institutions, relations, agreements. We must adhere to these laws for our own vested individual interests, because failure to do that means that today is Yemen, tomorrow it could be any one of us. These people cannot be trusted. They are
I would agree with that. My next issue is this. Why is Yemen
of strategic...
Have another question for you. From your research and being a Yemeni, why is Yemen of strategic geopolitical importance to Saudi Arabia and the United States? For example, its geographical position in oil reserves or other natural resources we don't hear about. What would be the motive for the U.S.-supported Saudis to want to dominate Yemen, and what do you believe the long-term goal is for the Saudis to absorb Yemen?
Well, it seems this has been their ambition from 100 years ago. This is not the first time they have tried to take over the Yemen. They've tried that several times. Historically, I don't know how, if you have a clear idea of how they came about and grabbed power in the region in the first place. They're just a bunch of Bedouins from the deserts, basically, that got together with this religious fanatic freak called Mohammed bin Abdul Wahhab, who gave them theological support. And they committed genocide against Hashemites in the Hijaz area, which is the Saudi region that houses Mecca and Medina. They committed genocide. Hashemites are descendants of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi. They committed genocide against them, stolen all their goods, and they then started to move on into Yemen. They tried that, but they were sent back, and they tried that several times again in the 60s and other times. They were repelled. But they never gave up their ambition to take over the Yemen, because, you see, the southern Hadhramaut region contains some of the most important parts for the rest of the world. For example, the Aden port is one of the most valuable ports in the world, because the water at the port is so deep that you don't need any kind of a bridge or some kind of thing to transport goods or things from and to the ship. So the ship docks at the yard and instantly does its loading and unloading, with the water being deep enough for the ship to be there. So that's great value. No other port in the world has that. And that port, Aden port, is Bab al-Mandab. Bab al-Mandab is the Mandab passage is as important as the Suez Canal, because everything in the world from the East, Africa, elsewhere passes through that region. You can't get to the Suez Canal without passing Yemen, without passing Bab al-Mandab. So the Saudis and the rest of the world want control of the Yemen because of that important passage there, important. And of course, there is the Iran question, which I will come to in a minute, and that is only a label used to justify the horrors being committed against the Yemen. So Saudi interest has always been there in the Yemen. In fact, they never gave up their ambition to take over the Yemen. And when in 1978, the former president, they supported him, funded him as well, staged a coup and took over the country, Ali Abdullah Saleh, the Saudis literally purchased him, and he was in their pocket. So the entire regime that was running the country from 1978 to the Arab Spring was under Saudi command and control. The Saudis had a kind of a committee in their own government, Saudi government, whose job and responsibility was to pay the salaries of the corrupt officials that were among the former president's people, Ali Abdullah Saleh, to keep the Yemen under Saudi tap, which it was the case. And when I said that the Wahhabis fled into the Yemen, that's how they did it. And so they started building Wahhabi centers in the Hadhramaut region, which is predominantly Sufis and Shafi'is and some Zaydis and Christians and Jewish families. And they have Wahhabized the people to the point that the Sufis stopped practicing their old Sufi practices of visiting graves and doing things that were traditionally Sufi practices, for fear of being told that they are doing innovation and haram, and so thereby justifying murdering them or blowing up their mosques, which is what the Wahhabis usually do. They just blow up an entire mosque of people praying, of Sufis, Shias, or others that they don't accept as being normal. So the importance of the Yemen, yes. And furthermore, there are indications that the southern Hadhramaut region, and southern part generally, today included, contains substantial amount of oil reserve that hasn't been tapped into. That is in addition to other natural resources such as minerals, including diamonds and things like that. So the Saudis want to have control because their own reserves are drying up. They are indebted for the first time. They are facing deficits beyond imagination, in a state of panic. I think from about 10 years ago, people were speculating that Saudi reserves are running out. So they're losing control of world power, if you like. Their power is money, and if the money goes, they have no power. So their interest in Yemen is really predominantly that. One, on the political side, they've always felt threatened by democracies or republics. Because look around the area, you will find Oman is a sultanate. Qatar is some sheikhdom, fiefdom. The Emirates is some other sheikhdom, fiefdom. Saudi Arabia, absolute brutal monarchic dictatorship. And Bahrain, same. Bahrain is in fact now under Saudi occupation from the Arab Spring days. And they're committing untold genocide there as well. So they have that political interest. They want everyone around them to be like them, dictators. They can't handle democracy because it threatens their existence, do you see? So now they then tell us that part of their intervention in Yemen is to prevent the spread of Iranian influence in the region, because the Houthis are Zaydi Shias. Now, that, with the greatest respect, is the most disgraceful lie that any human being would dare come up and say that in public without feeling any slight bit of shame. Why? Because if Iran had any interest, firstly, Iran had its own problem with the sanctions and the nuclear business and all of that. And so it had no time to get involved in the affairs of Yemen, having already been entangled itself in Iraq and the ISIS fight, as well as Syria and the Daesh fight there. So, secondly, Iranians are 12 Shias, and Yemenis or Houthis are Zaydi Shia, so they're not the same. And even if they were the same, the fact is, even the CIA has admitted this, Iran has no hand in the situation in Yemen. The truth is, therefore, claim is just to pretend Iran is a threat to them, and Iran is now becoming best friends with another republic, namely the Yemen. So they want to stop this spread of Iranian influence because they fear Bab al-Mandab or the Mandab passage will be under Iranian control. Already they're having problems with the Hormuz passage. They don't want the same problems to arise in Mandab. Again, that's absolute nonsense, because that's not how you resolve international relations. Iran has no interest in Yemen. Iran is a republic. It has done very well for itself. And if it really was involved in the Yemen, I don't think the Yemenis would have suffered as much as they have been suffering in any event. So the Saudi interest is basically to take over and swallow whole this country that its neighbor is next door and keep it with it. And that has been evidenced by reference to how they refused to hand back Jizan, Najran, and Asir. These are three regions in the southernmost part of Saudi Arabia and northernmost parts of the Yemen. These three regions are Yemeni lands, which were leased to the Saudis by the former President Saleh. And when that lease had expired, the Saudis have refused to return those regions and refused to negotiate. And of course, Saleh, being as corrupt as he was back then, wouldn't do anything about it. But now, with the war against Yemen, the Yemeni army has been advancing into Saudi regions, which includes taking back these three regions. So in essence, on the ground level, the Yemenis are doing very, very well, so far as they've now moved into Saudi land and brought the fight into Saudi land and forced the Saudis to be on the defense rather than on the attack. And they've also attacked an air base in another city, which is a Saudi city, which is called Taif. It's one of the most prominent cities of Saudi.
Well, let me put this in perspective as we're coming up to near the end of our program. I've seen maps that divide Yemen into three main sections. In the west, there's the Houthis, H-O-U-T-H-I-S, who are primarily Shia, a nonviolent religion. To the east is the territory controlled by the current Hadi, H-I-D-I-led government, which is the one that is the puppet regime of the Saudis. And then the Houthi territory is divided by swaths of land said to be controlled by Al-Qaeda and in the Arabian Peninsula. And then ISIS is supposed to also have a presence there. And so what we see is that now no one in the world would have thought that such a punch has fought back. They fought back. Not only they, even after they were almost totally destroyed, they're now actually going inside of Saudi Arabia and destabilizing Saudi Arabia. We know that the whole plan is to take over the resources because Saudi Arabia is at the end of its game. For the first time, they had to borrow money, and lots of it. Now, there's no problem loaning them money because they're good for the money. But what the world has to understand is Saudi Arabia is out of water, as that whole area of the world is. Now, in Yemen and other places, they've learned to live with very little water. Saudi Arabia, much like Qatar, uses a great deal of water. They have these very opulent palatial estates by the thousands, because each and every one of the 5,000-plus members of the royal family, the princes have enormous amounts of money. So they want the best of the best in the world, much like Abu Dhabi or Dubai. But they're out of water. And so that's a big crisis for them. So they have to go around the world finding places they can rent land or buy land. And then they start offshoring all of their assets, or a lot of their assets, I should say. around the world in case they're ever actually destabilized. And they also then have spent so much money fighting this battle that they thought would only take them a month. Well, they're now going into towards year two. So this has cost them hundreds of billions of dollars. So they've got hundreds of billions of dollars that they've spent on this, and they're not winning, they're losing now. They also are not getting any closer to being able to work through downsizing their welfare system, because in order to help their people, instead of buying them things that would make a difference, they simply gave them they would give them free gasoline, or they give them some free rent. Now they're taxing their people. That's not going to go down well. So not immediately, but the beginnings of the end of Saudi Arabia are with us now. I believe that Saudi Arabia, like all the other dictatorships, will find the revolution from within within the next several years. Next 10 years, Saudi Arabia will no longer be the country it is today, and the ruling family, the Saud family, will be gone to different parts, like in France, where you can buy yourself, you know, like Papa Doc Duvalier, who stole all the hundreds of millions of dollars from the Haitian people and then went to live there with that ill-gotten gains. Switzerland and the Riviera, they don't seem to have any qualms about inviting people in who have terrible records of stealing, crimes against humanity, and then as long as they put that money into that country. So I believe that's what's going to happen. I believe that sooner or later, you're going to see terrorists going after Saudi Arabia. You cannot fund over 22 different terrorist groups for years and then not have them come back against you. So that's going to happen. So expect the Saudi oil fields and infrastructure to be also attacked with greater frequency, and then watch the next rebellion. It might take one or two more rebellions before the people speak, but sooner or later the people will speak. And when they speak, they're going to speak loud enough to say, we don't want you. And then watch our position change. So we're out of time, Kim Sharif. That's Sharif. She's an attorney in the United Kingdom and director of the nonprofit human justice organization, Human Rights for Yemen. And she's Yemeni by birth, a Shia Muslim. And she's leading the effort to try to deconstruct the lies in the American and world media about what's happening in Yemen and Saudi Arabia's place in that human rights violation. Thank you very much, Kim, for being with us. I'm Gary Knoll. This has been the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you die. You know we